Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Pretty steady tone on the fed cattle markets. Feeder cattle markets perhaps a little bit weaker. But again, it's early in the year, so, you know, and kind of light volume trading, cold weather has impacted that a bit. So I think we probably need another week or two to get a little better sense of direction for these markets.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Darrell Peel.
We ended 2021 with a lot of optimism, carrying some momentum out of the year. That's certainly carrying forward here in the first part of January. Again, I think it'll take a little bit of time to see how the tone of the market really develops over the next 2 or 3 weeks. But, you know, most of the underlying fundamentals are very strong. We do have these areas of concern, the drought being a big one. But from a price standpoint and a market standpoint, we have a lot of optimism and certainly expectations in general for higher prices in 2022.
This is Agriculture Today.
So I think if you take a look at what we're doing, it boils down to more new and better markets. It boils down to making farmers and equipping farmers with the ability to be the great stewards of land and water that they are, but to take full advantage and to seize the opportunity out of the climate challenge we face. It's a department that is very focused on making sure we get help and assistance to those who have been negatively impacted by weather and climate in a very serious way, and trying to provide those resources as quickly and simply as possible. And never losing sight of the importance of our export markets. So I hope that you walk away with an understanding this is a department that's truly dedicated to all of you, truly dedicated to American agriculture.
That's Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in Atlanta on Monday at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention. And he also answered a very popular question.
You know, people ask me why I became the first secretary in the country's history to actually come back to this job. No one had ever done that before. And I said, it's very simple. I love the people I work with, and I love the people I work for. The people I work with are just an extraordinarily dedicated group of people who throughout the course of the pandemic, as they dealt with issues at their home and dealt with issues with their children, dealt with issues with their relatives and friends who were perhaps struck with COVID, they showed up for work. Now, they may not have come to the office, but they showed up for work and they got the work done, a record amount of work, I might add. They are really dedicated to all of you. They understand and appreciate the important role that you play in our country. And I love the people I work for because I know you. I know what drives you. What drives you is faith. What drives you is family. What drives you is community. What drives you is country. And I know that you appreciate and understand the incredibly vital role that you play in this great democracy of ours. You see, there are many, many countries out there that envy us because we have the capacity to feed our own people. We should never, ever take that for granted. That is an extraordinary advantage we have in this country, and it's a result of incredibly hardworking people who get up at all hours of the day, in all weather conditions, under extraordinary circumstances, whether it's a pandemic or a drought or a wildfire or a storm, and who understand and appreciate the job they have of feeding their family and America's families and the world's families. So it's not hard to understand why somebody like me, who started out life in an orphanage in Pennsylvania, wouldn't jump at the chance to come back to this great department. So I want to end by simply thanking you for what you do every single day for our country. Indeed, as the President indicated, you're the backbone of this country. And I want you to know that every single person that works at USDA is very, very appreciative and very understanding of the work that you do for us and the important role that you play in making America the great nation that it is.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's Agriculture Today.
This has been Scott, Scott Land Company in Dimmitt, Texas. Look at our website, scottlandcompany.com and texascrp.com, to view many properties we have currently listed in Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Colorado. Give us a call at 800-933-9698 to discuss these properties in detail. Give us a call at 800-933-9698.
Ring in the new year with savings at South Plains Implement. Looking for a new ride? Get great deals and financing options across a wide selection of John Deere lawn equipment during the Winter Green Sales event. Have time to tackle repairs on harvest equipment? In-stock peanut and cotton harvest equipment parts 15% off. Ready to plow into planting season? South Plains Implement offering 15% off complete sets of tillage parts. Some restrictions apply. Offers end January 31st at South Plains Implement, where farm meets family.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So the agencies do not appear to recognize the cost and burdens of having a broader scope of jurisdiction. We know this because the agencies, and I quote, this is from the proposed rule, the primary estimate is that the proposed rule would have zero impact on any business, let alone small businesses. So that couldn't be further from the truth.
Courtney Briggs is Senior Director of Congressional Relations, American Farm Bureau Federation, on Waters of the U.S.
The proposed rule only retains two exemptions, the wastewater treatment exemption and the prior converted cropland exemption, but it takes PCC back to the original 1993 definitions. So, unfortunately, we made a lot of progress under the Trump administration with the NWPR in clarifying PCC, and all of those wonderful steps of clarification that were made are now turned back. And the rule really tries to lean into this administration's themes of science, climate change, and environmental justice. And we see them reaching quite far on these themes.
She was speaking at the recent Farm Bureau Annual Convention in Atlanta and said the bottom line.
So why do farmers and ranchers care? Because the regulating low spots on farm fields would require folks to comply with Clean Water Act permitting requirements under Section 404 and 402. So if you're moving dirt or applying product, you would have to go to the Army Corps and ask for permission. What kind of activities are we talking about? We're talking about everyday activities. Plowing, planting, fence building. If you're doing any of that near an ephemeral drainage ditch or a low spot on the field, then you have to go to the federal government and ask for permission. So what's the problem with having to go and get a permit? Well, that requires time and money. And it can take many months to get a nationwide permit, or it can take many years to get an individual permit. And the cost can be exorbitant, not only the cost of the actual permit, but the cost of delay and mitigation can be quite high. So for all these reasons, we have a very keen interest in how they define waters of the U.S.
So the big question now, what happens next?
I mentioned it's a proposed rule. We're in the middle of a comment period. And the comment period ends on February 7th. And we need all of you to act now and let the agencies know that this rule is bad news and we need to retain the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. There'll be many opportunities for stakeholder engagements over the next few weeks, including regional roundtables where we will discuss the specific regional impacts that WOTUS has. And look, there's more fun to come because this is step one of a two-step process that the agencies have laid out. So they intend to do another rulemaking on top of this, likely to clarify many of the broad aspects of this rule. And of course, likely more litigation, and no, that the only people who win in those scenarios are the lawyers. It doesn't do anything for the regulated community, and it doesn't provide the clarity and certainty that farmers and ranchers need to operate their businesses.
That's Courtney Briggs with American Farm Bureau Federation. It's Agriculture Today.
When it comes to farming in dry conditions, the formula for success is simple. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why growers looking to improve yield potential while protecting their bottom line rely on dry, tough, dryland cotton varieties from Delta Pine. Bred, tested, and made tough to handle the toughest growing conditions. Stay strong this season. Plant dry, tough, dryland cotton varieties from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Making memories on your own piece of land is priceless, like skipping rocks across the watering hole, wetting the trot line, or teaching your youngster how to drive the ranch truck. Capital Farm Credit is the financial partner to help you realize those memories. We offer competitive rates and flexible terms on farmland, ranch land, and recreational property. Let us finance your dreams. CapitalFarmCredit.com.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
There's several things immediately given the time of the year. Of course, in the central and southern plains in particular, wheat pasture is an important winter grazing activity. That's really struggling right now. Our wheat pasture was never real good. We had dry conditions, got some moisture in October, planted wheat, got some up, put some cattle out. But now, with no more moisture to follow that up, these pastures are really falling apart pretty fast.
That's Oklahoma State livestock economist Darrell Peel.
So that's a that's an immediate concern in terms of the regional cattle markets. And then, of course, as we get into later in the spring, the question will be sort of what kind of spring do we have? If these drought conditions persist or continue to expand, as you mentioned, in the southern plains, they're already continuing in the northwest, although there's been some improvement in the Pacific Northwest, but in general, we have a lot of potential for some very serious concerns and some serious decision-making that'll have to happen in the first, 4 to 6 months of the year if conditions don't change.
Now, Peel also looks at box beef to start the year.
It's actually picked up a little bit, and that's not too uncommon. After holiday featuring and all that, then we come into January. We sometimes see beef sort of rise up again as a featured product in January. So we did see about a $3 or almost a $5 increase through the week last week on choice box beef. And, again, it's a testament to the underlying strength of demand. Compared to where we were this time last year, we're running, I don't know the exact percentage, probably 25% above a year ago at this time. So we continue to see very strong, particularly middle meat prices, but really across the board, across all of the major primals and subprimal cuts, general strength in these markets.
So are there any questions that demand will remain strong?
We do have some questions going forward. I mean, a lot of this is coming out of sort of the residual effects of a lot of pandemic-related things. We had a lot of stimulus money. Consumers spent, a year and a half really not doing things the way they have done in the past. They didn't travel as much. They didn't get out and do things as much, and so on. So as we go forward, there's some broader macroeconomic issues that we're watching. But in general, there's no indication at this point in time that beef demand is set to weaken in any significant way. And we continue to see, extremely strong demand. Obviously the current COVID situation could impact food service again. Mm-hmm. So we're watching that as well. I don't think it'll have a major impact or anything near like what we've seen in the past, but it could be a little bit of a bump in the road in terms of that food service demand and the ability of folks to get out and enjoy those restaurant meals.
Last week, White House and USDA announcing funding to increase packer capacity.
Well, I think there's several things, potentially behind it. It stems out of a lot of just general concerns about the way the industry has operated over the last couple of years and the broader concerns about capacity issues and the infrastructure in the industry. So, these federal support, it's probably not a bad thing. It may help some smaller markets, some specific markets, if you will, that could be very beneficial to, a smaller set of producers, a smaller set of consumers looking for a certain kind of product. I don't think it really changes the overall picture and certainly doesn't change the immediate situation with respect to capacity issues in the industry. And for that matter, then, to the extent that the administration has said that, they hope these will help alleviate some of the higher prices we're seeing. I don't think this really addresses that because I think there's some broader supply and demand conditions that explain high prices for beef, and this isn't really going to change that.
It's Agriculture Today.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turnroads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
Take the guesswork out of preparing your cotton for harvest with NanoPro. Utilizing NanoPro's revolutionary nanoliquid technology, your harvest aids go to work faster and more efficiently, increasing leaf drop, reducing regrowth, and helping your cotton be ready when you are. Offering a 3-to-1 return on investment, you can't go wrong with NanoPro. Learn more or find your nearest dealer by calling Tracy Carrillo at 575-639-5110 or visit aquayield.com.
This is Agriculture Today.
I've heard the 2008-2009 financial crisis discussed a few times tonight, and we're going to go back to that for reference once more.
Dustin Shearer is Director of Congressional Relations with the American Farm Bureau Federation at Farm Bureau's annual convention in Atlanta.
For those that remember, at the time, we had a huge shock to the financial system. And Congress passed a stimulus bill that at the time was an unprecedented size. It was about $831 billion. And people were questioning about whether or not it was too large, whether or not it wasn't enough. And in retrospect, it turned out to be just about right for what we needed. We needed to create some demand. $830 billion in 2008, at a time an unprecedented amount of money. What I would like to talk about today a little bit is the amount of money that we have plugged into the economy since March of 2020 to give you an idea of how much money is floating in the economy. March 18th of 2020, we passed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, $225 billion. 2 weeks later, we passed the CARES Act, which was $2.2 trillion in coronavirus relief. And that had a round of $1,200 checks for all but the most wealthy. April 24th, we passed the Paycheck Protection Program, which was a program we created so that people could continue to get paychecks even if they weren't allowed to go to their job. In December, we passed a $920 billion bill that sent out another round of checks to everybody and continued enhanced unemployment. And then in March of 2021, we passed the American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion, and another round of checks. We recently passed an infrastructure bill that had $550 billion in additional new spending. So since March of 2020, on top of normal federal government spending, we have put about $6 trillion of extra money into the economy. And at the same time, we gave people the option of waiving their mortgage or forbearing on their mortgage for up to a year. We gave people the option to not pay student loans. At the same time, providing them additional dollars in their pockets to spend. And so Roger's going to talk about some of the things that the Fed has done, but you can look from all the extra money that's floating around and the fact that for a while we told everybody to go home and get addicted to shopping on Amazon, that it's driving up prices for a lot of things and not just fertilizer.
So, Shearer, talking about federal spending, but do we have an income or a spending problem?
In 2016, the last year of President Obama's administration, the entire federal budget was $3.85 trillion. In 2021, for the first time ever, Treasury collected over $4 trillion in tax receipts. So we technically this year, had we just kept federal spending flat from 2016, would not have had a deficit for the first time since the Clinton administration. Instead, we ran a $2.78 trillion deficit because the federal government spent $6.8 trillion. That's the amount of money that's floating out there. It has a lot to do with the inflationary effects that we're seeing, and that's why we're concerned about even more spending going forward.
That's Dustin Shearer with the American Farm Bureau Federation. It's Agriculture Today. The best thing you can put on your crop is your shadow. Your need to be in the field won't change, and the Cotton Research and Promotion Program was put into place to make sure you get the most from every minute you're out there. That's why the Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated work alongside growers to spur innovation, fund research, and foster sustainability so generations of farming families can walk the same turn rows for years to come. Forever Cotton. Visit cottonboard.org/forevercotton.
How did all that FiberMax cotton grow so strong? Well, it's been a season sleeping on a bed of rocks, breathing dust and sucking wind. It hung out in blistering heat while fighting off posses of vicious pests and diseases. Yes, sir. That bounty of cotton grew so strong by being just as tough as you are. FiberMax Cotton from BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Transportation is essential to agriculture, right? You need to get your products from farm to market, from out of the ground to wherever they need to go, abroad, wherever state they need to go, or city.
Talking supply chain interruptions, Danny Munch with the American Farm Bureau.
40% of our freight movement in the U.S. is trucking, 30% is rail, and the rest is split between air, water, other, and pipeline. So obviously trucking and railways make up the bulk of the transportation system when we're talking about moving our agricultural products. So when we start to think about some of these supply chain issues, we have to look at the sort of intersection with COVID-19, how that interrupted the supply chain and how it kind of rippled into consumer behavior and how they purchase goods and services.
And he explains changes to rates.
Pre-2020, pretty stable, slight increase in trucking rates. We see a steep drop off when COVID comes through and consumers say, hey, we don't really need to shop anymore. Gas prices kind of plummet. No one really knows what's going on. Then government funding stimulus checks come out. People have a lot of money. They start buying stuff. They're not really buying services. They're not really going out, but they're buying plenty of stuff, plenty of TVs, air fryers, and what have you. And that fills up trucks, that fills up container ships, and that, you know, really creates a pinch point in the supply chain for especially trucking. So as you can see, just a precipitous increase in your trucking price index, 32% from over 5 years ago in 2019, 29% from May of last year. Similarly with your railways, a little bit different from trucking because they're privately owned and operated. So, you know, if you have a railway, there's a carrying capacity, right? You can only move products on the railways that exist. You can't just add new railways every day. So because of that constraint, we've seen increases as well as demand for product grows, as imports grow and the movement of goods and services increases. So corn, soybean, wheat have gone up 13, 11, and 7% over the last year, and ethanol transportation rail rates have gone up 20%. Similarly, it's just the involvement of the private industry in railways and how competition plays a role. As I mentioned, you know, if there's only a limited amount of railways that exist, it's a little bit easier for those private companies to control some of the pricing that exists for farmers and people and our customers of the railway service. So you can see over the last 20 years, the percentage of non-competitive rail revenue has gone up from about 20% to almost half of all rail revenue controlled by some of the largest private railway companies. And when you have less competition within the railway pricing, it becomes more difficult for farmers, for producers to really negotiate pricing and lower those rail rates overall.
And there are other ocean freight concerns.
We've also seen, you probably heard stories about the number of empty containers that are returning overseas without U.S. product in it. And that's kind of displayed here, hovered around 52% of all exports were empty in early 2018, and we got up to 71% in quarter three of 2020 returning empty, not with U.S. products. So definitely when you have that much demand emphasis on your ports, all this material coming at once, a lack of truckers, it's kind of shown here in how many are being sent back empty. And then, again, another kind of measure that we could use is just the wait times. And you've definitely seen stories about this. But this is the number of vessels waiting at anchor off one of our largest ports, Port of Los Angeles, which handles 17% of all of our imports and 5% of our agricultural imports. The average was zero prior to COVID-19. And then over the last few months, we've gone up to 32 boats a day, a minimum waiting. And you've seen some of those imagery.
It's Agriculture Today.
On the phone with Joe Guzman, Director of Sales for Equinom Smarter Sesame. Joe, 2022's here. You have lots of opportunities in sesame.
That's right, Stephen. We have grain handlers with 2022 agreements ready to be signed. Smarter Sesame makes a great rotational crop for producers who are planning for the new crop and season. With inputs on the rise, Smarter Sesame is a great choice for low-input acres.
Joe, if somebody wants to find out more, how can they do that?
They can call 1-833-SESAME or visit Equinom.com.
For years, Texas cotton growers have had a trusted partner when it comes to choosing their varieties. NextGen brand cottonseed from Americut. NextGen varieties bred specifically for West Texas growers have performed year after year, even in harsh conditions. And for this year's season, there are several new Bollgard 3 Extend Flex varieties available. Contact your local NextGen representative or dealer today to learn more about varieties suited for your needs. NextGen, your West Texas partner for performance cottonseed.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
USDA's December Hogs and Pigs report places the December 1st inventory of all hogs and pigs at 74.2 million head, down about 1% from last quarter and 4% lower than the same time last year, compared to an average pre-report estimate of just 2.8% lower.
Dr. Jason Franken is an economist with Western Illinois University on the recent USDA Hogs and Pigs report.
That's the smallest December inventory since 2017. While pre-report expectations accurately pegged the breeding herd at just a tenth of a percent higher than a year ago, the market hog inventory is similarly down about 4.5% compared to expectations of only 2.9% lower. All weight classes of market hog inventories are down compared to the same time last year, and all except the 50 to 119-pound class are down more than expected pre-report. The heaviest two weight classes are both down about 6% lower than a year ago and well below pre-report expectations, which were somewhat more accurate for lighter weight hogs. The 50 to 119-pound class is 2.5% lower compared to expectations of 2.7% lower, while the under 50-pound inventory is 3.7% lower than a year ago, just 0.8% lower than expected. Overall, there are nearly 4% fewer hogs weighing under 180 pounds than a year ago, and these will be the market hogs arriving at processing plants from January to May 2022. These numbers and farrowing estimates add some bullish sentiment. For instance, the decline in lighter weight hogs partly reflects that the September to November pig crop is 3.6% smaller than last year, despite a record number of pigs saved per litter, as 4.8% fewer sows were farrowed for the period compared to expectations of only 3.1% fewer. The record 11.19 pigs saved per litter continues the upward trend observed over the last decade. Still, a smaller fall pig crop resulting from fewer sows farrowed should imply a similarly smaller slaughter this spring. While winter and spring farrowing intentions are similar to actual farrowings from a year ago, the fact that both are below average pre-report estimates by 0.3% and 1% respectively seems somewhat bullish. That is, lower than expected farrowing intentions, unless offset by pigs per litter pushing still higher, should translate into lower inventories later on.
And we know going forward for cattle prices, there is optimism for higher prices. What about the hogs?
The forecast presented here is for the national weighted average net price on a carcass basis for all transactions for producer sold barrows and gilts, including negotiated and contract prices. This net price should be more reflective of what producers receive on average and normally runs at a premium of more than $2 a hundredweight over the base price on average. From October through December, this net price averaged $79.56 a hundredweight compared to $63.84 a hundredweight for the corresponding net prices for negotiated or spot transactions. In general, hog prices tend to be higher in the second and third quarters than in the first and fourth quarters. Consistent with that pattern, this forecast places first quarter prices at about $80.83 a hundredweight, rising to $91.37 a hundredweight, and then to $92.93 a hundredweight by the second and third quarters, respectively, before dropping to $83.27 a hundredweight for the fourth quarter. These projections assume that domestic demand maintains current levels and export demand grows in the later half of the year. A big wild card there, of course, could be how African swine fever might affect competitors in export markets. Of course, if demand is lower or if hog supply turns out to be greater than anticipated, then lower prices may be realized.
It's Dr. Jason Franken, Western Illinois University livestock economist. It's Agriculture Today.
What can you get for 2 cents these days? How about new, more efficient wheat varieties? Better market access for Texas wheat producers and increased demand to your product. Each year, the Texas Wheat Producers Board achieves these goals by investing producer contributions to promote wheat through research, education, and market development. Who knew 2 cents could be so valuable? A message from the Texas Wheat Producers Board.
Every drop counts. Introducing the Patriot 50 Series Sprayer from Case IH that puts every drop of product exactly where you want it. Enhanced LED lights, a cab designed for all-day comfort, and more precise spraying technology. Because just like you, we know every drop counts. Visit your local Wiley implement for details on the new Patriot 50 Series Sprayer.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, you know, I don't have strong evidence, you know, that we're having significant slowdowns. Certainly it's a concern. You're seeing, general concerns being expressed. Weights have ticked back up just a little bit on the slaughter side, and that may be an indication of a little bit of slowdown in processing. The preliminary numbers for the first week of January for daily slaughter were down, you know, from the previous week or two prior to that. So it's something that we have to watch.
So are COVID cases affecting processing? Oklahoma State livestock economist Daryl Peel.
Now, we know that at the same time, you know, feedlot numbers are a little bit tighter and generally going to get tighter. So it's kind of a race now to see whether or not we fall farther behind on the capacity side and the labor issues relative to the pace of cattle coming out of the feedlots and the timeliness of getting those cattle processed.